This is Fresh Air. When it comes to arms sales, the U.S. may be sending out a mixed message. It's pledged to restrain arms sales, but it's still negotiating multi-billion dollar arms deals. Michael Clare writes about this in the current issue of The Nation. He's their defense correspondent and is an associate professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. We called him today to discuss some of the latest arms developments of the post-Cold War era. The Pentagon just proposed suspending production of new weapon systems. The plan calls for continuing research and development of prototypes, but the actual production of the weapons would be postponed until a crisis seemed imminent. This plan would dramatically change the defense industry.
The main significance, of course, is for American defense contractors because they won't be able to count on the revenue that would come from going into full-scale production of these weapons. And that will mean a drop in income, and it'll probably mean further layoffs for employees of these firms. So the main impact will be economic, and it will be felt domestically.
What's the Pentagon's reasoning?
The Pentagon's reasoning is that with the end of the Cold War and the virtual disappearance of the threat from the Soviet Union, we don't need to keep producing new and ever more sophisticated and capable weapons because we're not going to be facing an enemy that continually upgrades its weapons. The Soviet threat is more or less frozen where it is now, and it's not likely to develop further. So we don't have to engage in a continuous arms race of ever greater, more sophisticated technology.
You know, it's unusual, isn't it, to read about the Pentagon initiating its own cutbacks?
Well, given the circumstances, it's not so surprising. They know that right now we're in a tremendous economic recession here in this country and that Congress is looking for ways in an election year to seem responsive to constituent concerns about the economy. And they know that the Pentagon budget is a ripe target for sources of funds that can be transferred to other programs, for domestic programs. So what the Pentagon is doing is something like a preemptive strike. They're saying to Congress, we're going to make our own cutbacks, so we don't need you to come in and tell us what to do. We'll do it our way, and that way we'll get the best end of the deal under the circumstances.
I guess this really puts Congress on the spot because there are a lot of jobs on the line in weapons manufacturing. It's always been a dilemma, I think, even for people who support ending the arms race. What happens to all the people who were employed by it?
Yes, this certainly will be a problem for Congress people who come from districts with large defense contractors. In Connecticut, for instance, in our area here, United Technologies just announced significant cutbacks, and that will certainly have an impact on the Connecticut economy. And we see the same thing in California and Texas and St. Louis, areas with large defense contractors. They will feel the heat.
As the Pentagon cuts back on its contracts for arms production, are U.S. arms manufacturers turning more to the world market?
This has historically been the experience that when domestic defense spending declines, American defense contractors will seek to increase their sales to foreign markets. And we see a lot of evidence of that today with the current slowdown in American spending. American defense contractors are working very hard to drum up new business abroad, especially in the Middle East and in the Far East, in the Pacific Rim area.
How much independence do arms manufacturers have in America in pursuing clients abroad? What kind of restrictions do they have to work under?
Defense contractors have a pretty free hand in going out to promote new business. There are limitations. There are things they're not allowed to sell, like nuclear weapons and nuclear technology, and there are certain markets that are off limits, like Libya and Syria and Iraq and Iran and so forth. Those restrictions aside, American companies are allowed and do engage in a wide variety of marketing procedures and efforts to drum up new business.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. We'll get into the international arms market. My guest is Michael Clare. He's an associate professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, and he's the defense correspondent for The Nation. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Clare is with us, and in the current edition of The Nation, he writes about the international arms market. In London, the United States and other members of the UN Security Council pledged to restrain arms sales. In your current article in The Nation, you make the point that there's two contradictory influences at work here. On the one hand, you know, the United States is pledging to restrain arms sales. On the other hand, you've got all these defense contractors looking for new markets abroad.
That's quite right. We're in a funny position here, where the end of the Cold War is welcome news for many of us around the world, but on the other hand, it does dry up the market for many weapons producers, and therefore they're putting a lot of pressure on their governments to permit increased sales to the Third World. And that, of course, is the area where we've seen a lot of conflict recently. So while we'll have a reduced level of conflict in Europe with the end of the Cold War, it could result in pressures to sell more weapons to the Middle East, where we can see an increase in conflict, possibly.
Would you describe for us the agreement that the United States reached with the other members of the UN Security Council recently in London?
These were the talks of the so-called Big Five, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, and they've been meeting since July to work out a series of guidelines for the conduct of arms sales. Now, this is not an agreement in the sense of a treaty where we're bound by the language. Rather, it's an agreement where each one of the parties to it agrees on their own to restrain their arms sales in certain ways, not to sell weapons that are very sophisticated to areas of conflict where it could spur an arms race, not to sell weapons that have an offensive character like long-range bombers, or other weapons that could be used to ignite a regional conflict, and also not to sell to countries that are at war. So these are very sound guidelines and could help restrain the arms trade, but there's nothing in this agreement that requires the governments that signed it to take specific steps to implement them.
Do you think that the United States has political reasons to continue selling a lot of arms, or perhaps even to sell more arms than it did before?
The United States has both political and economic reasons for selling more weapons to its friends in the Middle East. I think in the wake of the Persian Gulf crisis and the kind of alliances we forged with countries in the area, the Bush administration is very eager to retain close and friendly ties with some of those countries, countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and of course our long-term ally Israel. And these countries want more sophisticated weapons. They want the kind of weapons that we used to win the Persian Gulf War. And therefore, the president is under a lot of pressure to supply them with these sophisticated weapons.
So which instinct do you think is going to win out, the one to restrain arms sales or the one to keep selling or sell more?
My impression is that under the circumstances, the pressures to sell are going to outweigh the pressures to restrain arms sales. I say that because of the economic situation that we talked about earlier. That is to say, with the decline in defense spending within the United States and the pain that American defense contractors are going to experience, they're going to put a lot of pressures on the president to allow increased sales abroad to take up some of the slack. And I think that the president is going to bow to some of these pressures. In fact, we've seen evidence of that with the administration's willingness to help American companies market their weapons in the Third World.
You said that there are new markets opening up for arms, the Pacific Rim, for instance. Which countries did you have in mind, and why are they interested now in acquiring more weapons?
The countries with the greatest increases in defense spending in the 1980s are largely in the Pacific Rim, countries like South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia. These countries have experienced a considerable increase in their national income, as their industrial strategies have proved so effective. And along with rising income, they want to have stronger defense forces.
Well, another thing that's happening right now is that the United States is trying to rethink its nuclear strategy. There was a military advisory panel that recently urged the president to respond to the breakup of the Soviet Union by having American nuclear weapons targeted at every reasonable adversary around the world. Can you elaborate on what this nuclear doctrine would be?
Well, this is an attempt by Air Force officers and military analysts to come up with a rationale for retaining nuclear weapons in the post-Cold War era. It's the title of the report is The Role of Nuclear Weapons in the New World Order. And it tries to find a reason to keep weapons that many people think are no longer necessary with the end of the Cold War. That is our large stockpile of nuclear weapons. And the report suggests that emerging superpowers in the Third World may someday down the road, decades from now, pose a significant threat to U.S. security, and we therefore have to retain an ability to attack them with nuclear weapons.
What's the status of this report? The report was issued. Bush has been advised. We haven't accepted this strategy yet.
No, this is an advisory report. It's circulating in the Pentagon, and no doubt there are other such reports that haven't come to light. But my sense from reading the Pentagon literature is that there are people within the military hierarchy who are really determined to preserve America's nuclear capability. This is seen as a hedge not only against third world countries, I might add, but also against Germany and Japan, against the risk that they may someday remilitarize in a very significant way, even acquire nuclear weapons, and pose a military as well as an economic challenge to the United States. So American strategists want to maintain the one trump card they see, which is our very large supply of nuclear weapons.
Looking back to the international arms market, now that the Soviet Union has disbanded, the Soviet Union isn't going to be selling weapons or sending weapons to its allies or other countries in the way that it once was. Who's filling that vacuum now?
We have to remember that the defense companies that were once under Soviet control are now under the control of the respective states that comprise the Commonwealth of Independent States. And this means, in the case of defense industries, largely the Ukraine and Russia. And these republics or these states are very eager to acquire foreign currency for their economic problems. And they're very actively trying to sell weapons in the Third World. There are reports of Russian salesmen in the Middle East and Asia trying to sell what used to be Soviet weapons, but which are now being touted as Russian weapons. And they've apparently had some success. Another country that's trying to take up the slack from the former Soviet Union is China, which has aggressively been marketing its weapons in the Middle East and elsewhere in the Third World. And they see this as a valuable source of currency and as an opportunity to expand their influence in the region. And so there's been quite a bit of friction between the United States and the other suppliers in China, which has been reluctant up until now to curb its arms sales.
So how much of the economies of Russia and Ukraine do you think are going to be based on weapon sales?
My impression is that arms, that weapons, are one of the few commodities that the newly independent states of the former Soviet Union have for which they can find an overseas market, for which anyone is willing to pay hard currency at any rate. Most other Russian or Ukrainian products are too poor by international standards to find customers in the world market. But that's not true for Russian weapons or Soviet weapons, which, while perhaps not quite as good as American weapons, are still represent the best that Soviet technology was able to achieve. So for that's one of the few products, I think, for which the Russians will find overseas customers. And thus it's going to be a very important part of their effort to garner hard currencies for their very troubled economy.
Michael Clare is defense correspondent for The Nation and associate professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College.